I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Which animal was the original behemoth?
What makes ministers minimalist?
And what was kept in the very first chapel?
This week we are taking Words Unraveled to church as we learn about priests and popes and the language of religion.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Words from Hell and the upcoming Useless Etymology. And this is a more sanctified episode of Words Unraveled than usual. Hopefully we don't get too far into our usual naughty bits. But here we are. We are on the Church of, you know, holy curiosity around etymology.
Yeah, so hoping this one won't be the usual unholy mess. So why are we doing an episode about religion? Well, the church, because they got a new pope, right? I know we're a few weeks behind. Sorry.
We do have a new pope.
But we thought it was a good opportunity to go into the many words in the English language that come from the church that you might not know they do come from the church, but also the many words that are associated with the church, because I will briefly touch on the history, I'm sure, but the church and the English language have been intertwined since the English language was, you know, became the English language, really, and beforehand.
There's so much to dive into here, but I'm excited to start with the Pope. It's exciting to have a new Pope, at least in my circles, because I have a lot of ties to Chicago, and he is from Chicago. So my social circle is very excited. Also, lots of Bears fans, so there are many, many Bears jokes to be had here.
Are the Bears good?
No, they're awful. But hopefully, having the Pope on our side will help that.
Well, we'll see, having the Holy Father on your side.
That's it though, right? Holy Father, that's what it means.
Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it? So Pope is related to, like, you know, Papa, when you call someone your Papa. Indeed, it comes from the Greek Papas. And that doesn't just mean, it does mean Father, but it does mean it in a sort of cute, childish way, like Papa or Dada does. You know, it is a sort of loving, adoring way of referring to your father. And originally, the papas, the popes, were any bishop, really. But then, I mean, in English, it's a good 1,000 years ago, it starts to only really apply to the Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
In classical Latin, it was also a name you might call your tutor or anyone else who teaches you.
Ah, right. Okay. So an overall sort of role model of sorts. Yeah. So the most holy bishop, the Pope. Bishop's a good word to go on to next, I think. Let's delve into some religious titles. They've got a long history in the English language. What I think is surprising about bishop is the other words that it's related to, because it doesn't necessarily look like them, does it?
Like episcopal?
Exactly. Yeah. Because it comes from, well, okay, so let's say it comes from the Greek episkopos and the Latin episcopus, right? But we don't know how it does, because bishop and episcopus, obviously, you know, they've got some sounds in common. You've got the p and the b, which are very close to one another. And early versions of the word bishop in English and the West Germanic languages do, rather than have a sh sound, have a sk sound, like episcopal. But we don't actually know how that word ends up getting from, well, I suppose, the Mediterranean to Northern Europe in the way it has.
Quite mangled, it seems.
Yeah.
Skopos, the Greek root of this, also meant like guardian or protector. And we get this sort of shepherdy guardian of the flock notion throughout many words for clergy, right? Like the word pastor, which as recently as the 14th century was a word for a shepherd or a herdsman, directly borrowed from the Latin pastor, meaning shepherd and related to pasture. But throughout its history, it's also been a word for a spiritual guide or a minister, as much as it has been a word for a clergy person.
Right. Yeah. So we've got some father figures, mentors, and teachers, right? A lot of these religious words are invoking those ideas, aren't they?
Another parent one is abbot, originally an Aramaic word for, from an Aramaic word for a father, and then feminized in the 6th century in Latin to ultimately create the English word abbess as well.
Ah, okay. What I thought was interesting, just going back to bishop, is that we call them an archbishop, and that arch bit comes from a Latin word. But before we were calling them an archbishop, the Anglo-Saxons were calling them a high bishop, a here bishop. But what, this is a little bit childish, but what I also like is that there was an old English alternative of archbishop, a northern dialect version of it, which was arsebishop. It's just a variation on arch, but at the same time, it's still quite funny. And yeah, the most senior bishop was the archbishop. Actually, there's a hierarchy, you know, that's throughout the old English, the church around that sort of time, because you've got the archbishop, below them you've got the bishop, below them you've got the priest, and then below them you've got the deacon, and that's kind of the order of it. Priest is quite an interesting one, comes from Latin presbyter.
So bishop is too Episcopal as priest is too Presbyterian.
There we go. That's exactly where I was going. Yeah. But it could mean anyone who held a position in the church. If you wanted to be specific about the one that stands at the front of the church and, you know, read stuff out, you would call them a mass priest, a massa priost.
And it literally means elder, right? The Greek words it comes from mean elder or aged.
Correct. Indeed. Yeah. And then deacon, again, from Greek diakonos, Latin diakonos, meaning a servant or a messenger. So you kind of get the idea that that is slightly below that of a priest.
Similarly, a minister is related towards like minimum and minus and minor. It's one like a person who's humble and who is also like either a servant or an underling, but particularly in a church context, you're sort of like lesser person in the ranks, or just a servant in general, which is why we have like a prime minister and a minister of defense still means the same thing, but it's because they are serving the public good.
What's interesting about minister is that it is not as closely related to the word minster as you might think. If people have heard of a minster, because there aren't minsters everywhere. It's kind of a big cathedral. There are only a handful of them around. We'll get into the names of buildings. We'll stick with the titles first, and then we'll get into the holy buildings, because there's plenty to go into on that as well. Cardinal. Have we talked about cardinal before?
We may have addressed it, but let's go over it again.
Yeah. So cardinal comes from a word meaning thing that can serve as a hinge, cardinalis, from Latin. And I suppose that's because the cardinals were kind of the people upon which the fortunes of the church hung. You know, they were pivotal. Pivotal is a good way of putting it. So other references to cardinal in words like cardinal number, for example, which are the numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, the round numbers as we might call them, are all about them being sort of pivotal and important numbers. And then when you've got references to cardinals like the bird, the cardinal, or the apple, the red cardinal, that's a reference to the robes that are worn by the cardinal.
To the red robes. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's great. I think that's why we brought this up on an earlier episode about like animals and birds and things.
Yeah, I think so. It could easily have been in our colors episode as well, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and do you know what we didn't mention? Conclave. Obviously, it's not a title, but the conclave is the gathering of the cardinals to decide on the new pope. And conclave comes from the Latin con, meaning with, and clavis, meaning keys. It was originally the room in which the cardinals would meet. It would be a room that you could lock so that no one could access it. Conclavis, with keys. And then eventually it ends up meaning the meeting itself.
since we're sort of shifting toward locations, but also talking about clergy titles, monk and monastery. A monastery is a place to live alone. Both of these words come from the Greek monos, meaning alone.
Minster, by the way, also comes from the same root.
In a kind of reversal of those expectations, not meaning the same thing at all, nun is one of our other parental figures. It kind of is related to like nana, like your grandmother or something like that. But in Old English, there was a variation of the predecessor to the word monk, Munichin, which is a feminized version of Munich, basically a lady monk. And you will note that sounds very similar to the name of the city, Munich, which was founded by Benedictine monks. So,
Okay, because the old name for Munich, so it's München in German and Munich in English. And actually the older name of it was München, which is a mixture of the two. It's exactly that word you've just said, actually.
Right. Monk, yeah. City.
Monk town. Yeah. You mentioned nuns. Also, there's convent, right?
Which a place to come together.
A place to convene, indeed. Yeah, I like that. I didn't realize that. I mean, it seems obvious once you notice it.
Many monks and nuns are hermits, but that word has no particular connection to being alone necessarily. It does, but it means it's from the Greek word for desert. Or an uninhabited place. So, you know, you would go to the desert to be alone, perhaps. But a hermit is literally a person of the desert and was extended to Christianity through, you know, stories of going and wandering the desert for trials and whatnot.
I see.
Go to the desert for uninterrupted prayer, divine vibes, etc.
It's quite interesting, this idea that the monks were kind of solitary figures, because you absolutely think of them as part of a unit now.
Speaking of which, we've been talking about clergy, but we haven't addressed the word clergy itself. It's very interesting. It's from the French clergy, meaning clerics or learned men, and then also simply learning. Clergier was clerics, and then clergy means learning. But they both trace back to the Latin clericus, and then the Greek source of these words, kleros, means lot or inheritance, which you wouldn't think that would make a lot of sense. But the idea here is that is a Greek Christian notion from a reference in Deuteronomy when the Levites were described in the passage, therefore they shall have no inheritance among their brethren. The Lord is their inheritance. So someone who is an early Christian clergy person was considered a spiritual heir of divine service, literally someone who either drew the lot of God or inherited God as their lot in life. And the idea and Greek etymology are identical for the word cleric, which became a popular term in the 1620s, drawn from the same Greek root, clericos, belonging to the clergy. But I think this may have been an overcorrection, revisiting the earlier notion of the word clerk after it went secular, because clerk is from the same root, and in the 1200s was a word for a priest or ordained person, and it became a non-religious job because clergy people who worked for the church, tended to be literate, good at reading and writing, and ended up becoming like record keepers and keepers of accounts and scribes for kings on the secular side of things too.
Can I mention here the history of the English language and the church? Because we should talk about how the Anglo-Saxons come to be Christian, and that's why we end up with all of these Christian words in our language, you know, so many of them so early on in our language, in Old English. And it is because, you know, the Anglo-Saxons, when they arrive in Britain, they are not Christian. They are heathens of a sort. You know, they have many gods. Their gods are very similar to the Viking gods we know and love, but, you know, they've got slightly different names. But the reason I bring this up now is one of the reasons why, one of the appealing things about Christianity is that if you adopt Christianity, you get all the monks on side who just happen to be all the people who are able to read and write.
So right.
You suddenly gain all of these skills. It's not just that. Rome is sending missionaries over. Ireland is sending missionaries over as well. You know, the Celts of Ireland are coming over to try, because you've got to bear in mind that before the Anglo-Saxons arrive, Britain is Christian because it was run by the Romans, who were Christian, who converted the Celts that were living there. And so it has to sort of be, England has to be sort of re-Christianized anyway. And then, you know, once it does that, we end up with all of these words flooding in, and they stay in the English language.
Beautiful context. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What religious tradition were you raised in, and what were your clergy people called?
So my school was Church of England. which potted history of the Church of England is set up by Henry VIII because he wants to have another divorce and the Pope won't let him. So he sets that up. It's Anglican and it is very tame, I would say. It seems to me that the Church of England, a lot of it is about lemon drizzle cake, which makes it, you know, which is fine. And I suppose that would be the local religion where I am. I'm not religious myself.
Same. My extended family is Methodist for the most part, which is a long, you know, a various derivative of Anglicanism, but where it's very chill. Like it's like, at least the one that some Methodists are more hardcore than my extended family was. But when I was a kid, it was mostly like we go and build houses when they get knocked over by a tornado and chill at church.
Yeah, I like this side of religion. I mean, it gives people a reason to do nice things,
right?
if you need one if you need one,
right?
Yeah, indeed. We're talking about different types of church here, aren't we, which obviously refers to the building before it refers to anything else. To drag us back to the buildings, I've got a bit more on those, because church is like the original, it's the OG term for the holy house, and that's literally what it means. Actually, it means Lord's house. It comes from a Greek term, Kyriakon Doma, which literally means the Lord's house. So when we talk about going to church and going to God's house, we're being more literal than one might think. Do you know where the word chapel comes from?
Oh man, this one's great. A cape.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, so it comes from capella, right? Which does mean cape. It means specifically one cape, or at least it comes from specifically one cape, which I had no idea about. This is the cape of St. Martin, which was...
I love this one.
Yeah, so this was kept by the Frankish kings because they thought it was sacred. So the original chapel is the place where this cape is kept. It is, and then it becomes a name for a reliquary. Right, somewhere where you keep relics. So a chapel is named for what is in it. And that is also the case for a cathedral as well, because cathedral literally means where the bishop's seat is. And that can literally mean where his seat is, where he sits himself. It can also mean obviously where his HQ is. But I like those two things being, you know, descriptions of what was there, which means a cathedral does not have to be big. Right? It can be tiny.
Right. It sounds big.
Yeah, but exactly. Quite literally, the acoustics of the place as well. Yeah, there's nothing about the word cathedral that dictates it needs to be a big church.
I love that every chapel is named after one half cape in particular, because like the story goes that while serving in Rome, St. Martin cut his cloak in half to share with a beggar, and then he dreamed of Christ wearing the half cloak, and then the half that Martin kept was the relic.
Ah, right. And the people that looked after the relic were called the capellani.
The chaplains.
The chaplains. Yeah, exactly. Capellani.
I love that one.
Yeah, that is really nice. So those are Christian buildings. I did think we ought to represent some other religions as well in this episode. Just briefly, synagogue, for example, you know, Jewish meeting house. And it does literally mean, you know, a place to meet. It comes from the Greek for to bring together. Mosque is just a European massacring of the Arabic word masjid or majid, which means a temple, more literally a place of prostration. And then Gurdwara. I don't know if everyone knows what a Gurdwara is. It's where Sikhs worship. Really good if you've got a Gurdwara in town. They give out free food. And I don't
Sikhs
mean...
Sikhs are just, so cool.
They're super, super cool. Super nice. A big, like my hometown's a big sort of Sikh center in England. It's got a beautiful big Gurdwara. And they had these langar kitchens, right? Where you can just go and, yeah, they will give you a full meal for free. And it's not like a homeless alms for the poor sort of thing. It's just a thing. You go
there.
That's
awesome.
You get fed.
Community kitchen. I love it.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And the word Gurdwara, well, you can perhaps guess that the word guru is hiding in there. And that's what they call their spiritual leaders, including their book, actually, the Guru Granth Sahib, which is the final guru that, ultimately they do sort of worship. But the Dwara on Gurdwara is from the Sanskrit for a door. And it's words like that where you realize, oh, English and Sanskrit really are related, aren't they?
Right.
Because dvara and door so darn close together when you think about it, given the geographical difference.
We should definitely revisit other religions for another episode. I know since we're acknowledging the Pope, this is definitely a Christian-heavy episode, but there are so many other words across religious traditions that we could explore.
Yeah, I just wanted to give us a nod. So there are a lot of words in English that are first used in religious contexts that we now don't use in religious contexts necessarily, aren't there? Can you tell us about some of those? Because you've surprised me with this sort of thing in the past.
One of them is regular. Like before it meant ordinary or recurring, it meant monastic, basically someone who lives by a rule. I mean, it's got that regula thing, which is Latin for a rule or like a straight piece of something, which we also see in like ruler and things like that. Even a person who rules also is like following a set of rules or a straight and narrow path and is right in their justice and whatnot. But in English around the 1400s, regular first meant someone following a religious rule, a lifestyle defined by structure and discipline and predictability, which is exactly how it began to spread to words like, you know, shapes and patterns and behavior and, you know, gasoline.
Yeah.
Standard stuff.
It's almost as if things that are regular, that occur regular, are occurring as according to a rule.
And irregular was, ecclesiastically suspect originally. It was something that violates church rules.
Right. Okay. That, again, a surprising word from, you know, from religion.
And then let's see. So this isn't specific to Christianity, but supernatural originally meant, I mean, it literally means above nature, which I'm sure you could guess, but it referred originally to like divine intervention, miracles, and God's unexplainable power. And I suppose you could say that also applies to ghosts, but there are a lot like the supernatural things now are not considered quite necessarily as religious in nature.
Yeah, it makes sense. Sort of above nature, though, is what it means. Oh, I've got one. Enthusiasm.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's from the Greek meaning possessed by God. You know, it's enthusiasmos in Greek, and the thous bit there is theos, meaning God. So it does mean to literally to be possessed by a god. And originally in English, the word enthusiasm or enthusiastic is used a bit like we'd say he's a man possessed now. It's not a good thing. It's someone who's gone a little bit crazy with their obsession with something, which I really like. And on a similar vein, inspire from inspirare. Yeah, same idea. It means to breathe in, but the idea is you breathed in some sort of holy essence.
Like Greek oracles, right? Or that sort of thing.
Right.
Trippy God infusions. Another one is, I suppose, religious context is, I'm going to use that to apply to like Milton's Paradise Lost, because that gave us a lot of the like religious lore we apply to storytelling around religion today, even though it wasn't necessarily in biblical text itself. Yeah, but
it's
anyway,
not canon.
Right. But a lot of people think it is if it's in Paradise Lost. So anyway, pandemonium is the word I'm thinking of, which literally it was first used in Paradise Lost as the name of Satan's palace in hell, literally meaning all demons. So like pan and demonium, essentially, the capital city of hell.
I recently did a crossword on my channel. I just sat for an hour and did a crossword and filmed it and put it up on my channel.
That was a good video.
Oh, thanks for watching. Pandemonium was one of the last clues that I actually managed to get. But it was in there. It was a beautiful clue.
That's awesome.
I don't remember the words for it. Here's a good... Well, okay, I've got a few more of these, actually. Behemoth. I don't know if everyone knows that behemoth is first used in the Bible. And John Wycliffe, his translation of the Bible, has behemoth in it. And it's basically just a pulling of the Hebrew word, which rather suggests he didn't know what a behemoth was either, because we're still trying to work out what the heck the animal that God is referring to when he says, "Behold now, behemoth, which I made along with you, it eats grass like an ox." So behemoth is a plural noun in Hebrew, but it's thought that the plural is being used as a sort of mark of respect to the animal. And what it actually means, what behemoth actually means, is great beast. So it's a plural of a behemoth, which means just beast. So early on, the interpretations are, okay, so what's the greatest beast? It's an elephant. So is God, when he's speaking to Job, you know, pointing
talking
at an
about
elephant.
An elephant.
Yeah, but then it becomes clear from the context that this animal is amphibious. So that led people to think
a hippo.
It's a hippopotamus, right? And that idea is so entrenched now that the Russian and Ukrainian words for hippopotamus are behemoth. How cool is that?
So many of our words for big things have like story lore behind them, right? Like, because we use Goliath as a word for something large, and yeah. then
Leviathan.
This is by no means a religious text, but Gargantuan is also named after Gargantua and Pantagruel, which is an extremely lewd story.
Just finally on behemoth, though, there's a slightly sort of newer, deeper understanding of where this word might have come from, which is Egyptian, very hard to pronounce, pehemau, although it, you know, it's ancient Egyptian, so we don't actually know what vowel sounds were made in there because hieroglyphics don't include vowels, which would mean water ox. But again, no one's really sure what a water ox is. Not too helpful. But yeah, behemoth comes from
hippo.
In the Bible. Yeah, exactly. A river horse, right? Which is
right. That would make sense to me.
Yeah, that's what hippopotamus means, river horse, by the way. Yeah.
Speaking of which, you said a couple things here. One, that this word is plural, unexpectedly-ish. You mentioned Egyptian sources, so I would love to briefly address the word Bible because it has two of those elements involved in it. Bible is from a pluralization, essentially. Yeah. It's from the Latin phrase Biblia Sacra, meaning holy books. So like the collection of books in one, which was interpreted as a feminine singular noun in medieval Latin. So Biblia, meaning books, became the singular French Bible, which was also used as a word for any really big book, which is why we also still have like bibliophile and things like that. Latin got it from the Greek ta biblia, ta hagia, the holy books, and the Greek biblion meant scroll or paper, which was originally a diminutive of biblos, a word for papyrus, which was likely referring to the Egyptian paper exported from the Phoenician port of Byblos in modern-day Lebanon. So yes, the Bible is essentially named after a shipping hub.
That's marvelous.
Right.
I had no idea.
The big book of Phoenician port Byblos.
So every French library, every bibliothèque is named after a port far, far away.
Mm-hmm. Supposedly, yeah.
So when we talk about Bible, what we're really talking about is the books. Right, the books.
Which makes sense. I mean, we still call them books of the Bible, right?
Indeed we do.
Books of the books.
I've got another word that comes from the Bible that, again, people might already know, but the story behind it is worth repeating if people don't. The shibboleth.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, this is a good one.
Yeah.
My book, Words from Hell, was accused of being full of sinister shibboleths in one of the negative reviews that I got, which it's funny. In the book, I also address the fact that sinister means left-handed. So they're saying that the contents of the book reveal me to be a leftist.
Oh, okay. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised if the book contained explanations of both the word sinister and shibboleth.
So I don't think it contains shibboleth, but it does contain sinister. Maybe the next edition for shibboleth, because now I have to.
So what is a shibboleth? I suppose we should explain. I mean, it's often used to mean a term that is exclusive to a certain group, to the extent that you can tell whether someone is part of that group or not by their understanding or, you know, ability to even say that word.
It doesn't just have to be a word though, right?
No.
It can be anything. It can be a gesture, like a practice, a custom. The big example from movies that helps you kind of get it right away is from Inglourious Basterds, right? Because Michael Fassbender throws up a three like this. I'm holding up my three, my index and middle and ring finger. And then he's revealed to not be a Nazi because you would hold up your thumb, index finger and middle finger.
I included that very clip in a video I just did about numbers, actually.
Excellent.
I was a bit led astray talking about a shibboleth needing to be a word just because that is where the word comes from. The story relates to the fact that shibboleth was a word. It was a word to the Gileadites, who had just won a war against the Ephraimites. And because they had won it, they were able to blockade the River Jordan and stop anyone who was trying to cross it. So if an Ephraimite turned up and wanted to cross, the Gileadites would ask the Ephraimite to say shibboleth. Why would they do that? That's because though the two groups did speak very, very similar languages, the language of the Ephraimites didn't have the sh sound in it. So they would struggle to say the sh in Shibboleth because their version of the word was Sibboleth.
Ah, very nice.
So the bit in the Bible, this is from the book of Judges, says, the men of Gilead said unto him, so this is an Ephraimite who's trying to cross, art thou an Ephraimite? Oh God, that's hard to say. if he say nay, then said they unto him, say now Shibboleth. And he said, Sibboleth, for he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passage of the Jordan.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, you really ought to say it right. But you can see how you end up with that story getting us to a point where the word Shibboleth means, you know, a term that's used by people to recognize people from, you know, from their own crew.
From other groups or from their own groups. And, like, it doesn't have to get you killed. Like, both of the examples we just gave involve, like, terrible things. But, like, a lot of the like, UK versus US differences that we've identified in our episodes about that would, you know, if I were to go over and put on a very convincing accent, I would still say things that would reveal me to be American because of my word choices.
One we do where I come from is there's a little village in Derbyshire, the name of which is spelled C-R-I-C-H. And the way we assess whether someone's local or not is how they pronounce that place name. C-R-I-C-H. It looks like Critch. But it's,
I would say Crite.
Not far off. It's Critch.
Critch, okay.
Yeah. If you pronounce it any other way, you ain't from around here.
I was just going for like Michael Crichton's name, essentially, because it's spelled similarly.
Oh, yeah, that's a good guess. They've got a very nice tramway museum in Critch, which I can highly recommend.
Very nice. Let's see, another word that you might not expect to have come from or at least first appeared in religious contexts would be edification, which really had less to do with intellectual edification and more with spiritual edification. You're quoting Paul, essentially, when you say it. It's from a Latin word for building. English church writers borrowed it to mean like the building up of the soul, and not metaphorically at first, like sort of as a straight architectural project, like a spiritual house with pillars of faith and plastered over with good deeds and whatnot. But by the 1600s, it was expanded to mean more like mental and moral developments in general.
Ah.
So something that is edifying, like this very podcast, means it's doing a little construction work in your inner sanctum.
That's lovely. So again, that's one of those explanations that's going to change how I think about that word, and it's
right.
going to change how I use it. But it's going to mean I use it in a more elegant and apposite way. I like that.
Mm.
Another word from the Bible, or well, that is popularized by the Bible and gets its modern meaning from the Bible, is the word talent. Have you ever heard this story?
Oh, no, tell me.
This is quite an unusual one. The original talent, right, was a weight, a measure, usually used
for
a weight of silver. Yeah, so
I it also became stories.
Right. So it was a name for a measure and then became the name of a coin that weighed a talent. So, for example, the Babylonian talent was worth 3,000 shekels and the Greek talent was worth 6,000 drachmae. I didn't know that drachmae was the plural of drachma, but there you go. So it gets its current meaning, the word talent, from the parable of the talents, which is in the Gospel of Matthew, where a master gives his three servants a load of talents, basically, a load of coins, gives them some money and tells them, go use it wisely. One of them just buries it, gets nothing out of it. But the other two are smart with their talents and come back with twice as much as they were originally given.
And so more talented?
They were more talented. Exactly. They'd been smart. They were more talented. And so that's where the word ends up taking on its current meaning. So it goes from being a weight to a coin to this completely abstract thing that the word talent means now. And, you know, traditionally a talent was something that was God given. Now it's, you know, it's a skill that you just are born with. But originally, yeah, it is a sort of a religious idea of you being given your talent.
Some people would say, like, if you have like a natural born talent versus a cultivated skill, sometimes people would separate those two notions still.
I think you should. There's a TV program called Britain's Got Talent, and I always thought it should be called Britain's Been Practicing, because basically, well, you know, these aren't talent, they're skills for sure.
But according to the original story, it kind of makes more sense for it to be a skill because these people are being prudent with their money, not like automatically, inherently better with money, you know?
Well, this is true. This is true. Where have they learnt this ability to be frugal, or whatever it is that they managed to do, to invest well? Was it a God-given ability, or did they learn it? Yeah.
Another word, which I don't think will be that surprising that it's, you know, biblically related, but because we use it for like a genre of sci-fi entertainment now, some people might not have like fully made the connection that Apocalypse is the Greek name for the book of Revelation, and it means the exact same thing. It is an unveiling, and apo means off, and then the other part means cover or concealment. So to uncover something or reveal it or revelate it. Same idea.
Actually, the link between the words reveal and revelation, I don't think are as obvious as they could be, just because of the way it's pronounced being so different.
It's also a little bit butchered. There's a little funkiness here in English. So English first butchered this word, interpreting it with the spelling as apocalypsis, as two words, in the 11th century, before it was re-Greekified as apocalypse in the 1200s. And then the more Latinized revelation was a John Wycliffe thing in the 1300s.
Okay, so he's given us what, the revelations, and he's given us the shibboleth. Among other things.
This word, like, it took on this, like, non-religious, end-of-the-worldy sense pretty recently, like, in the past couple of centuries, through the connection between, like, apocalypticism, which referred to the belief that, like, the revelation was nigh.
It sort of doesn't make sense of it, meaning that the end of the world, really.
Right, yeah. All is revealed by God, and then the world ends. Yeah. That's the notion.
I know everything. Oh, it's all over. Oh. Damn it.
All is revealed to the believers, and they get yeeted to heaven.
So there's a word that's kind of similar and also has a religious background. I'm sort of half remembering this, is apocryphal as well.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the crypt in there is the same as you've got in like cryptos or cryptocurrency, indeed. But, you know, it means hidden. So something that was apocryphal was originally hidden. And then eventually it comes to mean something that was of spurious origins. You don't know where it came from. It's of hidden origins and therefore not really trustworthy. So when we talk about an apocryphal tale, we talk about a tale that probably isn't true. Can I give you another couple of phrases that come from the Bible that surprised me when I learned about them?
Yeah, let's do this.
The land of Nod?
I did know about this one, but I want to hear about it.
You know all of them. There's no way of surprising you.
You totally surprised me with, what was it? I don't remember.
I surprised you. Learned a new thing immediately. Okay, so anyway, the land of Nod is a very specific reference to, yeah, where God banishes Cain to after he's murdered his brother Abel. He says, and Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. East of Eden, another reference there. That's in the King James version, by the way.
Fantastic Steinbeck book as well, with lots of comparisons to Cain and Abel.
Very good. It's a proper, like, sort of school text, isn't it? And anyway, Jonathan Swift is credited with being the first to use the land of Nod to mean going to bed, which is quite cute. Really? Because I think of sort of nodding off to sleep. Yeah. So I actually genuinely don't know if the phrase nodding off comes from the idea of the land of Nod being sleep, or whether you are sort of nodding off to sleep. Or is like Jonathan Swift making that link? If you know, let us know in the comments. A very niche bit of knowledge, but maybe someone does know. And the other one that I wanted to mention was the writing on the wall, which is a biblical reference.
I didn't know this one.
Ah, yes. Come on. So King Belshazzar one night spots a disembodied hand writing something on his wall. It writes,
creepy.
Many, many tekel upharsin, which means numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. It's gibberish, basically.
Also very creepy.
Yeah, super creepy. But that is what the original writing on the wall is. So a prophet comes to interpret what this writing on the wall means and says, Mr. Belshazzar, sir, your majesty, King Belshazzar, you're going to be overthrown. Hmm. Oh, is that's what it means? Yeah, that's what it means. And yeah, by morning, Belshazzar's dead.
Oof.
So the writing really was on the wall. Yeah, and that's where that comes from. And sometimes you will hear people saying mene, mene, as an alternative phrase to the writing is on the wall. Maybe that's a bit of a shibboleth, actually, because not a lot of people understand it. Someone might say mene, mene to you, hoping you won't know what they're going on about. And really, they're trying to tell you that it's almost all over, because that is what it means. It's from that inscription in the story of King Belshazzar and the writing on the wall.
I did, by the way, double check whether, like, to what extent or what the order between the land of Nod and Nodding Off was. And Nodding Off was already in existence long before land of Nod became a pun on that notion.
Okay, so yeah, so Swift is punning on it. Good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is it time to put this episode to bed, to pass around that metallic dish that you put your donations in and then quietly file out between the pews of this episode of Words Unraveled?
That sounds perfect. Let's end this sermon and revisit church-themed things another time.
Okay. Thanks for watching. We'll catch you next time. Amen.
Beautiful.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.